Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In the first part of today's program, I welcome back anti-imperialist journalist Abby Martin of the Empire Files. We'll discuss foreign policy and the U.S. presidential campaign, and we'll also talk about what will likely not change after the November election regarding foreign policy. Abby Martin then gives us an update on her First Amendment lawsuit case in Georgia. Later in the program, journalist and filmmaker Eleanor Goldfield rejoins the Project Censored Show to discuss U.S. political culture in 2020, issues around vote shaming, and she highlights the importance of local politics while explaining the kinds of grassroots work that still must be done for progressive change under a Trump or Biden administration. Stay tuned.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of the program, we welcome back Abby Martin. Abby Martin is a visual artist and an anti-imperialist journalist. She's co-host of Media Roots Radio and creator of The Empire Files, an investigative documentary series through the lens of U.S. empire. Working with Project Censored, Abby Martin also was the lead editor and narrator of our recent film, United States of Distraction, and Abby's feature-length documentary film from 2019 on the Empire Files is titled Gaza Fights for Freedom. And the last time we had Abby Martin on the program, we talked about her film Gaza Fights for Freedom. Today, we bring Abby back to the show because she's recently been producing work at the Empire Files looking at the foreign policy of both Joe Biden and Donald Trump as we approach the 2020 presidential election. We're also going to talk to her a little later in the segment about an ongoing lawsuit concerning academic freedom and free speech in the critical media literacy scene in Georgia. So Abby's going to catch us up to speed with that very important case. But Abby Martin, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mickey.
It's always a pleasure to hear from you, Abby, because you're always doing so many important things, particularly the Empire Files, A+ independent journalism and very important independent media that I believe people need to be following if they are not already. You recently did a piece that looks at foreign policies between the Democrats and Republicans, the Joe Biden campaign with Kamala Harris, and Donald Trump and Mike Pence. Why is it that you were focusing on specifically the foreign policies? It doesn't seem like we've been hearing much about that in the news in the U.S. at all.
You make an important point, Mickey, and I think it's really, really crucial to state the fact that there are many more people outside the U.S. who are impacted by the decisions of the American president than there are within its borders. And so it's quite a travesty that here we are children of the empire and we are just completely lacking any sort of substantive discussion on our corporate media about these things that our government does, these atrocities that are committed, the war crimes that are committed in our names across the planet. And yes, of course, there are legitimate differences when it comes to domestic policy. I mean, you know, despite Trump calling Biden and Harris far-left communists, Biden's objectively center-right. You know, at least he still acknowledges climate change is real and thinks that we should do things like implement a mask mandate or, you know, some sort of national coordination to deal with the pandemic, unlike Trump. And then there's the social issues, of course, like gay marriage, abortion rights and such that judicial picks from Biden would uphold. But when it comes to foreign policy, the choice becomes much more murky. And unfortunately, Trump, being the con artist that he is, knows exactly how to play to that populist base, despite reigning at the helm of the U.S. empire for the last 4 years, exacerbating and increasing militarism every which way. He still has managed to paint himself as this anti-war candidate. And so we've dedicated Empire Files for the last 4 years, ever since he got elected, into debunking that narrative that Trump is an anti-war candidate, that Trump is somehow fighting the military-industrial complex, the deep state. I mean, it's such a cartoonishly false idea. Trump, who appointed the top three defense contractors to the top three Pentagon positions, it's just like, okay. But I mean, you just have to dig a little bit deeper than the rhetoric that he displays on Twitter. Once in a while, he'll go on some tweet stream about ending endless wars or saying something during a speech about how they don't like me because I want to bring the troops home. We need to look a little bit beyond that rhetoric because it's quite meaningless. And again, he knows how to play to this base. And we have to look at what the actions are. What is he actually doing around the world? With Joe Biden, we have 40 years of policy history. He was a senator for decades. He's been the vice president under the Obama administration, reigning over the killer drone empire. And with Trump, I mean, he was a reality star extraordinaire. So it's really hard to look at his policy positions before he actually became president. But luckily, we have 4 years on record of him doing horrible things across the world. But bizarrely, Mickey, as you so aptly point out all the time with Project Censored, is that foreign policy is never discussed. What you never hear in the corporate media or the dog and pony show under the banner of electoral politics is that the United States is a vast global military empire, which rules other nations as territories, subjugates others as neo-colonies, overthrows independent governments, houses 800 major military bases in over 70 countries, and is drone bombing and engaging in combat operations in almost every continent. So once you understand that, you know, and you understand how we actually are complicit, Americans, it is our duty to stop this global death machine. And the fact that so many are just vastly ignorant of its existence is pretty disheartening. And despite the legitimate differences, or very small, let's say, differences when it comes to domestic policy, the differences in foreign policy are almost minuscule. And we can go over some of these countries because it's just really fascinating when you lay out the landscape of their positions across the Middle East, Latin America, China. At the end of the day, it's pretty much just a calculation of which administration would maybe pull back troops in one country, maybe some death and destruction in another country, and like which lives are quantifiably worth more. But it's really disturbing when you look at it in that perspective, because that's really what we're talking about, Mickey.
And I'm very glad that you brought up that domestically there certainly are some differences, though not as many as the parties pretend in their rhetoric. As Daniel Boorstin, the historian from the 60s, called presidential debates pseudo-events, basically stage-managed as political theater, right? And it's only gotten even, you know, weirder since then by most accounts. But you also, when you talk about foreign policy, we're still riding under the shadow of the war on terrorism. And now the COVID-19 pandemic crisis has given even more cover. I think it's really important to talk about specific countries and specific examples, Abby.
Let's start with the Middle East. When we talk about Palestine, I think that's one of the most stark examples of the similarities of the two parties. You rarely see any differentiation between the Democrats and Republicans when it comes to the support for the Israeli extreme right. And despite the rhetorical nonsense, you know, the platitudes that you see maybe from Kamala Harris or other Democratic officials, they simply support it. You know, there's really no policy that actually is in place, or no leveraging, no discussion of leveraging aid, for example, to actually try to push forward for rights and liberation for the Palestinian people, or certainly to end the 50-year occupation, military occupation of the West Bank. So Palestine, I think, is one of those examples that Joe Biden and Trump actually have a lot of similarities on. Of course, Trump's moving of the embassy was a horrific moment in time for the Palestinian people. Jerusalem is a sacred place, and Joe Biden has actually said that he would keep that move in place. He has no problems with Trump moving the embassy. AIPAC has given Joe Biden 100% rating. He went around after the Gaza flotilla massacre and actually said it was the correct thing to do, that Israel had every right to defend itself, even though that was a massacre of peace activists in international waters. And we know what Trump has done. Other than moving the embassy, which of course sparked off the Great March of Return, the premise of our film Gaza Fights for Freedom, which people can check out at Vimeo, he also has had such extreme loyalty to the far-right extremists in Israel that they've actually named settlements in the Golan Heights after Donald Trump. You had banners unfurled on buildings during Netanyahu's reelection campaign that actually displayed him shaking hands with President Trump. And he's said over and over again, you are the best friend that Israel could ever have. You have Jared Kushner overseeing these fraudulent peace deals that essentially just give carte blanche to Israel to steamroll over Palestinian rights. You had him completely eliminate any aid for the refugees that are living in Gaza. So it has been a devastating time under the Trump administration for Palestine. But in terms of Joe Biden, other than perhaps implementing the aid, reinstating that for Gaza citizens, I don't see any difference between policy. Now let's move on to Afghanistan. This is the country that Trump has said repeatedly he's ending the endless war in Afghanistan. It's become the forever war. It's background noise to Americans. The only time it really gets attention is when there's maybe headlines of people dying, right, or some suicide bombing or troops dying, which, by the way, under Trump is at an all-time high. So despite him saying he's ending this endless war in Afghanistan, he simply is not doing that. He doubled the troops in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria, by the way, once he got into office. He also doubled bombings there. He increased bombings dramatically. And also, when you're talking about the drone empire that Joe Biden was vice president under, Trump has increased that 400% across the planet. No one really talks about these numbers. It's pretty startling, actually, and the civilian casualty count has just skyrocketed. So we're talking about double the amount of civilian casualties and the lack of transparency, too. Trump has eliminated the transparency in order to see even what these drone strikes are doing, and he has boasted about giving the Pentagon carte blanche, taking the gloves off, as he said, to the Pentagon. So over the last 4 years, Afghanistan has seen a lot of bloodletting, not to mention, you know, the largest non-nuclear bomb, the MOAB that was dropped. It's just devastating when you see what the MOAB did. Completely left this region in ruins, and you had generals and commanders saying, we don't want to waste our time digging through the rubble to count dead bodies. It's absolutely offensively insane what they did there. And where does it stand today? Trump claims that he is overseeing this Taliban peace deal. That actually was started under the Obama administration. So again, he's taking credit for something that he didn't do. But it's also just absurd on its face that we have to actually be involved with a peace deal between the Taliban and the Afghan people. I mean, they should be able to have self-determination and be able to work out a deal themselves with the Taliban. And this is eliminating, of course, the contextual history of how the U.S. has played a role in shaping that region. Colonialism, empire, going back, let's say, to the Cold War, when we funded the Mujahideen to the tune of tens of millions of dollars and created that civil war strife that we're still seeing today, that violence, the unending violence that still is a leftover, a holdover from what we've done in the 80s there. And of course, bin Laden arising out of that mess and 9/11, and you can just go on and on and on. So Afghanistan, sadly, I have not seen any movement on the ground. Trump has not ended the war, and the Taliban peace deal keeps being predicated on these impossible benchmarks of having permanent U.S. presence, because I think that we all know that the reason the U.S. has been there for almost 2 decades is because we want some sort of permanent mining installation to reap the $4 trillion of mining wealth under the ground. And the pipeline deals. This is a pivotal center of competitors for U.S. capitalism. We have Russia right there. We have all these former Soviet republics that we want to be able to control access to oil, to mining. And I think that that's the point. That's why we haven't left. We want to make it a neo-colony, and we haven't done so yet. We have a global military empire that's subjugating tens of millions of people around the world, and predominantly black and brown and indigenous people. So it's absolutely the peak of hypocrisy and cynicism, and it's disgusting and it's embarrassing that this is what we're doing around the world. It's just a disgrace, Mickey. It's really a disgrace that these are the two candidates that we're faced with when really, and we can talk about Iraq. I mean, Biden championing the invasion of Iraq. Trump at the time actually said on the Howard Stern show that he supported it too. So even though he kind of ridicules Biden on that point, he supported it at the time. I'm sure if he was in office, he would have voted for it as well. Saudi Arabia, Trump vetoed that measure to end the war. Biden is saying that he would support ending the war. But of course, we know that when you have such a staunch partnership with the Saudi royal family, what does that really look like? How are you really going to end that? I mean, you may stop providing logistics to bomb the Houthis, you know, but like, really, I'm sure the weapons deals are going to keep soaring. I think Iran is one of the more stark examples of where detente could actually happen again. But really, I mean, why would Iran want to reinstate the nuclear deal if we've already just shredded it under the Trump administration? That's going to be asking a lot of them after Trump extrajudicially assassinates General Soleimani, you know, puts us at the doorstep of World War III with Iran. So even if Biden did get into office and say, okay, we're going to lift the 800-plus sanctions that Trump put on Iran and try to maybe reinstate this peace negotiation, it would be asking a lot for Iran to do so. How much are they going to take, really? But that, I would say, is the biggest difference between the two candidates. Then you have North Korea, where Trump claims he wants detente with North Korea. And then you have Kamala and Biden making those kind of snarky comments about how they wouldn't write love letters to dictators.
They'll support coups and dictators in other ways, in other places. just to wrap up this segment, take a quick break and come back, neither of these candidates would be at the top of the Democratic or Republican Party ticket if they didn't have a full-throated support from the military-industrial complex. These characters aren't going to be changing in many real ways or reasoned ways the current trajectory of our foreign policy, which is very unfortunate. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with Abby Martin, anti-imperialist journalist, co-host of Media Roots, and creator of The Empire Files. We'll continue our conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us.
You give money to the bums on the corner with a sign bleeding from their gums. Talking about you don't support a crackhead. What you think happens to the money from your taxes? The government's the addict with $1 billion a week. Kill brown people habit. And even if you ain't on the front line, when massa yell crunch time, you right back at it. Man, look at how you hustling backwards. At the end of the year, add up what they subtracted. 3 out of 12 months, your salary pay for that madness. Man, that's sad.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we're speaking with Abby Martin, anti-imperialist journalist, co-host of Media Roots Radio, and creator of The Empire Files, an investigative documentary series through the lens of U.S. empire. Abby Martin is also a documentary filmmaker, and you can learn more at theempirefiles.tv. Abby Martin, just before this break, we were wrapping up talking about some issues with foreign policy. And I had mentioned that both of these major party candidates seem to be supporting the further extension of U.S. empire. You wanted to add a couple of other examples.
I just wanted to briefly touch upon Latin America, because Trump has been an absolute disaster when it comes to Latin America, overseeing the coup in Bolivia, repeated coup attempts in Venezuela, and then, of course, the sanctions, right? You had John Bolton and Elliot Abrams, the cartoonish, evil Smurf villain who oversaw Iran-Contra, hiding weapons and aid shipments during that scandal, doing the same thing, trying to ram through that aid truck, quote-unquote, that actually had weapons in it during one of the repeated coup attempts last year. The sanctions have been devastating, killing tens of thousands of Venezuelans alone since Trump got into office. Cuba, reversing the normalization with Cuba. But let's just keep in mind that Biden, even though he might reinstate the normalization with Cuba, he still wants to overthrow the Cuban communist government. So it's just different tactics, timelines, and policies with the two parties. But we really have to zero in on Venezuela, I think, as one of the most ridiculous examples of this, because you have this assassination attempt also coming from the Trump administration on Maduro himself. You have an outstanding bounty on his head, this attempt to install this U.S. coup puppet Juan Guaido. And when you look at Joe Biden, when you look at the Democratic Party, they are not actually saying how offensive this is. They are not actually calling Trump out for the coup attempt, for the violation, the egregious violation of international law or the criminal sanctions that are killing tens of thousands of Venezuelans. No. They are applauding it. They are actually saying and echoing the sentiment that they want Juan Guaido, someone who's widely loathed in his home country. They are actually still praising him. In fact, I saw Joe Biden mere weeks ago saying on Twitter that Juan Guaido is the legitimate ruler of Venezuela. I mean, you just cannot make this stuff up. And then when it comes to pandering of like the Venezuelan exiles and the Cuban exiles in Florida, Joe Biden's doing the same thing. We know how much he loves to throw leftists under the bus. He's actually pandering directly to the right wing in Florida. He actually has paraphernalia on his website boasting that he's anti-communist. So I think it's really important to remember that the Democrats have really supported all of these policies. There's a near unanimous congressional support for Trump's military budget and bipartisan support for every criminal war, coup, intervention, and bombing campaign, pretty much in this country's history. So the war machine always wins. The war machine will win again in 2020. And that's why we need to build an anti-imperialist movement in the streets that fights both parties, because we cannot expect change at all if you care about peace and justice outside of this country through electoral politics. And let us not forget that this is why we can't have nice things here. We simply can't have health care, we're told, because we can't afford it. Meanwhile, we have a military budget bigger than the next 10 countries combined.
Yeah, and that's an ongoing challenge. Sometimes I look around and feel like it's the 1950s as far as how little ground has been gained in these regards. And certainly we do know, Abby Martin, no matter who wins the election here in 2020, we know the various countries that you've been talking about are going to be the losers. and many of us too in the U.S. that need many other things coming from our government are not going to get them because so many of our resources and over 50% of our discretionary budget goes to the war machine. Abby Martin, there's another topic we wanted to get to that's actually related to this one on foreign policy issues, but domestically. And that is, as you mentioned, it's not popular to be an anti-imperialist and a journalist in the United States calling out the impact of U.S. foreign policies in other countries. And it's, of course, also apparently not popular even in some academic circles in some states where there are strange gag laws, I would call them, about who gets to speak at conferences at public universities. And more specifically, we're talking about a case that you're involved in. This was in Georgia at the International Critical Media Literacy Conference that was canceled. Actually, Nolan Higdon and I wrote a piece about this back in January. This involves your critique of the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and your recent documentary, Gaza Fights for Freedom, that ended up in a really bizarre and surprising, in my opinion, censorship of you and your voice in this conference in Georgia. You're now involved in a lawsuit. What's going on?
This all started February 28th of this year. It was supposed to be the conference, if I'm not mistaken. It was the Critical Media Literacy Conference at Georgia Southern, and you were going to be involved in it in terms of you being Project Censored was going to be involved in it. It was going to be really great. I was planning for months to be a part of it until I was told that I must sign a pledge to not boycott Israel if I wanted to participate in the conference as the keynote speaker. Now, this is pretty shocking to me. I knew about anti-BDS legislation, but I was pretty startled, you know, to get one myself, to actually get the contract myself and say, you need to sign this in order to speak. Now, it would be absolutely absurd to sign the contract, considering I've advocated for BDS for my entire adult life. I mean, my political work for the last 10 years reports on BDS, advocates BDS, the entire film Gaza Fights for Freedom advocates BDS. So there's no possible way that I could comply with the request. And I knew, Mickey, that it was a violation of my First Amendment right to free speech and, of course, the right to participate in peaceful political boycotts. This is something that was upheld by the Supreme Court on the heels of the civil rights movement, I think 1982. They upheld the right to boycott as a means of political protest. So, of course, I said I could not sign. And, unfortunately, the entire event was canceled as a direct response to my refusal to sign this clause. So I decided to partner with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund out of D.C., a really great law firm, as well as CARE, to sue the state of Georgia over what I felt was a complete violation of my political expression. You know, situations of oppression and violence are really dear to my heart, Mickey. I mean, I should not be expected to throw these beliefs away simply to be able to work. And I think that that's really what it comes down to. I mean, it's outrageous that people, as independent contractors, no matter if you're working in construction, substitute teaching, or whatever, right, you're being told by 28 states in the U.S. that you need to actually forfeit your constitutional freedoms in order to work in the state. It's the most dangerous assault, in my opinion, on free speech since the McCarthy era, since anti-communist legislation. And the fact that this is totally under the radar, that you have a foreign government mandating a pledge, mandating Americans to sign a pledge to a foreign government, is absolutely beyond the pale. It's beyond absurdity. It really, really is. And I think if a lot of people understood what was going on, they would be absolutely outraged. And in fact, what was really fascinating is Netanyahu's office, shortly after I filed this lawsuit and I went to Georgia and had a big press conference, Netanyahu's office tweeted, quote, "Whoever boycotts us will be boycotted. In recent years, we've promoted laws in most U.S. states, which determine that strong action is to be taken against whoever tries to boycott Israel." I mean, you have a foreign country basically threatening economic consequences to dictate the constitutional rights of Americans. And he basically boasted that his Ministry of Strategic Affairs lobbied state legislatures to pass laws to do this. When these people were debating my lawsuit on the floor of Georgia, they actually said that Netanyahu himself was an influence in actually passing these laws in the first place. I just want people to stop and think about how crazy that is.
And the fact that this was happening at an International Critical Media Literacy Conference that Project Censored was going to be part of, the fact that you're being censored because of this other work, even though the conference itself is literally about critical media literacy and information freedom and openness and, you know, media democracy. And by the way, we hear all this constant noise about Russiagate and Putin and the Russians meddling in American affairs. And I don't know. I've not seen anything the degree to which you've just described with Netanyahu and Israel. This is directly meddling in U.S. affairs and constitutional rights. I mean, it's kind of riveting. And what Nolan Higdon and I wrote about in this Counterpunch piece, as democracy crumbles, silence speaks volumes, when we wrote about the beginning of this issue taking place earlier in the year, we were astounded that so few people seemed to know about it, number one, or to be speaking out about it. And so what has your experience been as you've been moving through the case?
It got a lot of press at the beginning, and it's kind of fallen by the wayside, of course, because of the pandemic. The lawsuit's kind of stalled because everything's virtual right now, but it's still in effect. Mm. I just got an updated brief from my lawyer. So it's still moving forward, and it's going to be interesting to see what Georgia decides to do. In other cases, in other states, they have actually tried to, in one of the states that this was brought to the government, they basically increased the cap from $1,000 to like $100,000. So meaning if you're an independent contractor, you only have to sign the pledge if you're making $100,000 or more. You know, so that was a way for them to kind of wiggle around and still uphold the anti-BDS clause while not overthrowing the law, which they did in another state. So we're hoping that if the court in Georgia understands the Constitution and they understand what's at stake here, which is really you can't even put a quantifiable amount on the right to free speech, the right to a political expression, right? These things are kind of unquantifiable. Like, they're very, very important things. So I think that if they are constitutionalists and they understand how important civil liberties are as lawyers, as they should, you know, as justices, then they would uphold my right to actually speak about anything. And they would overturn this anti-BDS law that is completely a violation of all of our rights, Mickey. And I really hope that they do the right thing. We're just going to have to wait and see. But in terms of other press, yeah, it's been picked up. And people, I think, once they find out about how absurd this is, they really are alarmed.
The more that we bring it up to people, oftentimes there's just disbelief. People are like, well, wait a minute. This was an academic event, a conference, and the whole thing is just shut down. I don't even know if you were going to talk specifically about BDS in the talk that you weren't allowed to give. This case is much bigger, of course, than you. You're looking at the net effect of a case like this and what it would have on these other 28 states, right?
That's a really good point. This actually was not even about me speaking about Palestine. This was about just me speaking about media literacy in general. And so it was a completely unrelated topic. It was a completely unrelated topic. I was not going to even discuss Palestine or my film. It was just simply, in order to speak at all, in order to work at all in Georgia, you have to sign this anti-BDS clause. I'm just a vehicle here. I'm using my voice as a tool. I'm using this case to hopefully spark outrage across the United States, to hopefully inspire other people to refuse to sign these anti-BDS laws. Because again, as I mentioned, this is 28 states across the country that have this legislation, and it's time that we stand up and say no more. And I think it's really important also, I think you and Nolan pointed this out in the article, that we hear the constant bemoaning about conservative suppression on college campuses. People like Milo Yiannopoulos, right, being prevented from speaking, and all these free speech cries from conservative punditry about people simply being heckled, protested against. What about this? What about the fact that political speech is being literally suppressed by the state? Mm-hmm. That to me is such egregious censorship. That to me is the most egregious censorship. And the fact that you have these free speech advocates hypocritically ignoring the anti-BDS laws in place really shows their hand, because this is not about free speech. It's about controlling speech. And that's why we need to stand up and say no more and fight these at the court.
And as we say here, no censors, K-N-O-W, and no censorship, N-O. We really have to support the free speech rights of people, especially in these public forums. We'll certainly be checking in with you again, Abby Martin, about this case and the rest of your work at the Empire Files. Abby, could you please tell people where they can go to follow your important work if they don't know already?
You can go to Empire Files on YouTube. You can go to the empirefiles.tv. You can follow me on Twitter at Abby Martin, and also Media Roots Radio, the podcast that I host. Check out our film Gaza Fights for Freedom on Vimeo. Thank you so much, Mickey. Project Censored is the best, and I really appreciate coming on.
It's always an honor to talk to you, Abby Martin. So thanks so much for joining us today. Coming up next on the Project Censored show, we'll welcome back Eleanor Goldfield, and we'll continue talking about the U.S. election and the political climate here in the United States. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are joined once again by Eleanor Goldfield, who is a creative radical journalist and filmmaker. Her reporting work has appeared on Press TV, RT America, and Free Speech TV, where she produced and hosted a weekly radical news show, Act Out, for 5 years. Eleanor's print work has appeared in Mint Press News, Roar, Popular Resistance, Truth Dig, and more. Her first documentary, Hard Road of Hope, covers past and present radicalism in the resource colony known as West Virginia. And we had Eleanor Goldfield on the Project Censored show to discuss her film, Hard Road of Hope. This film, by the way, has garnered international praise, a Best Woman Filmmaker Award, and has official selection laurels in 8 film festivals, including the Cannes Independent. Currently, Eleanor is host of the podcast Act Out and the co-host of the podcast Common Censored, along with Lee Camp, certainly something that's up our alley here at the Project, as well as the Silver Threads podcast with Carla Bergman. Eleanor Goldfield regularly contributes to several other podcasts, including By Any Means Necessary, Economic Update with Richard Wolff, Fault Lines, and more. You can learn about the many wonderful things that Eleanor Goldfield does at artkillingapathy.com. You can learn about her film, hardroadofhope.com. Eleanor Goldfield, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's always our pleasure. Eleanor Goldfield, we were just talking in the last segment with Abby Martin. We all had the pleasure of talking on a panel about the recent Project Censored film, United States, A Distraction, over at the Real News Network. And a couple topics that came up in our conversation about the U.S. election, the whole system of voting, the two-party structure, the corporate backing. I mean, so many issues around the election. And of course, we're in a contentious election cycle where people feel there's a lot to lose, so to speak. Not so sure what there is to gain coming out of the two campaigns. What's your thoughts been on the current election cycle?
The way that I think about it is that, no, we shouldn't diminish the danger of another Trump presidency. But at the same time, can we also not diminish the danger of a Biden presidency? We can walk and chew gum at the same time. Both things are true. And I think the problem is, and this is like not to get like into the psychological weeds here, but like I think it's based on the impending fear of the election and, oh my God, Trump's going to stage a coup. And, oh my God, fascism is just going to come out of nowhere because it's not like baked into the DNA of the United States or anything. And this fear of the upcoming election and then folks on the left saying we have to go for Biden because it's, again, the lesser of two evils and it's just about mitigating harm. When in reality, it's not, because you can't mitigate harm by going with an abuser. That's not how mitigating harm works. It's like going to a needle exchange program. Would you like the needle with AIDS on it or Hep C? It's like, well, can I just get a clean one or no? That's not mitigating harm. That's really the way that I look at this current election cycle. And I think it's very dangerous to suggest that Biden is going to be somehow this wonderful hero that saves us from the evils of Trump.
Well, Eleanor Goldfield, of course, you started by saying that any of the things that we're going to talk about and you're going to talk about in no way diminishes the consequences of a continued Trump presidency. I'm saying that particularly because some of our listeners have contacted me saying that Now more than ever, this election is the most important of our lifetimes. And if we don't get rid of Trump now, we're doomed. And somehow we're supposed to be quiet or silent about the analogy that you just pulled out there, the abuser. We shouldn't be mistaking these things. We shouldn't be saying that because we're pointing out some of the critiques of what's happening in the corporate-controlled DNC and Democratic Party, that doesn't mean that you're somehow automatically supporting Trump. And I know people will get into electoral politics and swing states. I'm here in California. You're in D.C., where those realities maybe look different. But, you know, we had Ted Rall on the program not long ago, and he doesn't mince words. He's a vicious critic of the Democrats and Biden. But again, some of the critiques we got here is that, hey, this isn't the time to critique Biden. This is the time to change the course, then hold their feet to the fire. And I'm old enough now. I've been hearing that since the Carter years, Reagan years. Abby Martin was just on a little bit ago. She was comparing the Trump and Biden foreign policies. And frankly, they're pretty similar.
Right. The Democrats are really good at saying, what do you mean we rigged the primaries? That's not something that happened. And it's like, but no, I saw you. I was there. It happened. And they're like, nope, I don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, oh, I don't know what you mean. Of course we believe in climate change. Of course we're working for a livable future. How would you like your fracking water? Would you like it? Like, it's like, wait, what? I don't understand. And so the Democrats really excel at this sort of at that gaslighting, which, of course, you know, ties back into the abusive relationship idea. And it's not just physical abuse in terms of whether that be like out in the streets getting tear gassed by cops, but it's the lack of access to health care, which the Democrats never want to support, the lack of access to education and housing and basic human needs. And then it's like that emotional and mental abuse on top of that. For people who say, well, we have to hold their feet to the fire, which I've been hearing that since like 2000, which is really when I started to get political. I'm like, where's this fire? And where are you getting a hold of their feet? It's this perpetuation of the same tactic that yields no results. And I would ask people, okay, well, if you feel that this is so important now more than ever, which I'm really tired of hearing that phrase, what is it that will change significantly if Biden wins? What is it that you are seeing that will shift so dramatically? Not only how do you see that shifting dramatically, but how do you see us holding their feet to the fire in a way that would get them to act the way that you hoped Obama would act on climate change or on the prison industrial complex or on the war machine or on, you know, universal health care and all things that he talked about with regards to hope and change? It's how do you see this playing out? And this is not me trying to be combative. I actually want to know, because if somebody can tell me, oh, okay, well, here are the answers to your question. Here's how this is going to pan out. But nobody has that answer to the question. There has to be a plan of action here, and I don't see it. I don't see where the policies significantly look different in terms of how that will mitigate the suffering of millions of people. It doesn't hold water at the end of the day.
Let's go back to those phrases. I agree, because as an historian by day, these kind of things are born out of expediency as catchy slogans. But, you know, previous generations have dealt with a lot of massive things, you know, whether it's the Civil War, the Nazis. So that's what propels people to say things like this. The fact that we're so hyperpartisan and siloed, and we have these confirmation bias media systems that further bifurcate or separate or keep people from actually talking about key issues, like you're hinting at. You're saying, well, what is this feet to the fire issue? That's another one of those issues, because we've been hearing that forever. I've been hearing that since Reagan. What I normally see is once one group is out, the other group kind of goes on vacation. We saw a lot of people coast through the Obama years, and Hillary Clinton won the last election with 3 million votes. Trump was electored in to office, so yet another president without a majority vote, even the plurality vote. And so there's this kind of great disappointment coming out of the 2016 election. And so this election, it seems that there's more of that. Well, we can't handle more of the Trump administration. And I realize there's a whole line of people that are saying that in this country. And some of them have far more reasons than others in terms of what the Trump administration has been for so many people, particularly of color, low income, and so on. But let's get back to that feet to the fire idea. So you are involved in a lot of grassroots political movements. So Eleanor Goldfield, since the established political order doesn't always come up with a lot of ways to tell us how that's going to happen, How do you think that that can happen? What are some of the things that you're doing that really matter on a grassroots level politically that might be modeled in a broader way?
One of the first things that I'll say is that I think because of the way we are taught about politics in this country, it's a very structured and confined way of looking at politics. And so we think that there's, you know, one or two ways of addressing an issue. But the idea behind mutual aid or really any way of working outside the confines of the system is kind of like what the Zapatistas talked about when they said, we want a world where many worlds are possible. There's not one way to fight the system or build alternatives. There are many ways to work around the oppression of the system, and we've seen beautiful manifestations of that thanks to the pandemic. For the first time in modern history, the disaster is hitting everybody around the world at the same time. So we can really look at people around the world to see how they're responding to this situation. And there is a book that I was lucky enough to be a part of called Pandemic Solidarity that basically took stories, shared stories from around the globe, whether that be, you know, Rojava or India or China or Argentina, about what folks are doing in the midst of this pandemic. And what's really interesting, Mickey, is that we're all suffering under the same global capitalist system. And it's clear to everybody in this book or in these networks that voting for your particular capitalist figurehead to move us out of this is at best, you know, for folks in Europe or for folks who have access to a more socialist or socialized government, is at best going to mitigate the harm in the immediacy. But long term, we're still going to be stuck in the same situation where the end goal is to make enough profit or make more profit, which is something that the world just can't sustain. And so when you look at it from this perspective, the idea of voting for someone who is an avowed racist, an avowed sexist, who's a war hawk, just doesn't make any sense. And the idea that you can push someone like this further to the left, that one day he'll just wake up and be like, oh my God, I agree, fracking is terrible. Or, oh my God, I agree, black people are people too. It doesn't make any sense based on the history of his career. And to be critically honest, based on the realities of the Democratic Party. And so what mutual aid networks for years have been showing people are ways to not only fight the system, but to build alternatives. And the power of building alternatives isn't just about, oh, let's create the world that we want to see, but it also crosses these divisive boundaries that we're taught to believe in. So for instance, if a libertarian walks up and is looking at our community garden, we don't ask him, are you a libertarian? No, we're like, hey, do you want to get in on this? Like, let's talk about food sovereignty. And it becomes a way of having these conversations with people that have been programmed or propagandized into thinking divisively. And so the conversation never pops up, who did you vote for? Who are you going to vote for? Because we understand that our future will not be based on checking a box marked Democrat or Republican. Our future, our ability to survive in the future, will be based on our ability to work together on this flat structure level and not pleading with the powers that be to give us some scraps and not trying to waste our time holding their feet to this imaginary fire when it's very clear, based on our country's history and the history of these politicians personally, that it's not going to give us the type of change that we desperately need in order to survive.
I'd like to remind our listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking right now with Eleanor Goldfield, a creative radical, journalist, and filmmaker. Her recent film is called Hard Road of Hope, hardroadofhope.com. Her website is artkillingapathy.com, and Eleanor does a lot of other things, including hosting the podcast Act Out, and also co-hosts the podcast Common Censored, along with Lee Camp. We'll continue our conversation about the U.S. election and U.S. politics after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we're speaking with independent journalist, creative radical, filmmaker, Eleanor Goldfield. Eleanor's work has appeared in Mint Press News, Roar, Popular Resistance, and Truthdig. Her first documentary, Hard Road of Hope, covers past and present radicalism in the resource colony known as West Virginia. And we spoke with Eleanor Goldfield about that earlier this year. You can learn more at hardroadofhope.com. Her website, artkillingapathy.com, you can learn more about her work there. Eleanor Goldfield, before we took that brief break, you were talking about mutual aid. You were talking about the necessity to be working together at the grassroots level to address the many challenges that we see. I'm going to play devil's advocate for just one moment to say there's a lot at stake for a lot of people in the election. A lot of folks on the left are confronting this dilemma of supporting Biden. I mean, again, it's no secret. Biden doesn't even pretend to be a progressive or someone on the left. Kamala Harris basically said he's a big fan of fracking. Biden has said that he doesn't really support the Green New Deal. He's got his own plan. So in other words, it's kind of like they're putting progressives out to pasture and saying, well, you don't have anywhere to go. So if you vote for a third party, you're throwing your vote away. If you don't vote for Biden, it's a vote for Trump. And all of this kind of falls under the rubric of this culture of vote shaming that's become sort of a sport in the U.S. Can you talk a little bit about that as a concept? And again, why grassroots movements are an antidote to that problem?
This sort of vote shaming always ignores the fact that did not vote is the most popular candidate in recent presidential elections. And basically what that means is that the vast majority of people just didn't feel inspired to vote for anyone. So the idea that someone taking, you know, even if it's 2% of the vote, like a Green Party candidate, is the big problem, just speaks to a real laughable misunderstanding of how the system works. And as you pointed out, Mickey, earlier, hypothetically, even let's say that someone like Jill Stein got to a good percentage, the Electoral College could just as easily say, nope, don't think so, which is exactly what they did in 2016. So people trying to shame leftists or Green Party voters or third party voters, why are you not shaming the Electoral College for existing? This brings me back to this point that, to me, we shouldn't be focusing on vote shaming. We should be focusing on system shaming, because vote shaming is just about lambasting each other for either feeling that we need to be voting or that we don't want to vote because it's so rigged and so corrupt. When in reality, all of those issues, all of those problems are connected to the systemic corruption that is inherent in our electoral politics. So we're busy yelling at each other, and meanwhile, the powers that be are sitting back with a cigar and being like, yes, continue your arguments. And I understand if people feel like, look, I'm going to vote for Biden. I completely disagree with you, but feel free to go ahead and do it. But I also think that part of that conversation has to be, regardless of whether you're voting for Biden or you're writing in Mickey Mouse, voting is not how we change the system. Even if Bernie were on the ballot, and when people were like super excited to vote for someone like Bernie, who, by the way, is not even that left, we have to recognize that voting is like using your turn signal when you're driving. If you're swerving in between lanes, but you're using your turn signal, that doesn't make you a good driver. And using your turn signal is not going to stop that 18-wheeler from T-boning you. So it's important that we put voting in the context that it actually exists in, and at the same time understanding that our election system is totally rigged. So even if you feel really strongly about a candidate, chances are that your vote could get thrown out, it could get miscounted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are so many barriers to a democratic voting system in our nation. So I think all of these things put together means that, again, the issue is not whether we're shaming each other for how we vote, but it should be system shaming and putting voting in the context that it actually exists in, and focusing more energy on the issues that we can address outside the confines of the system that they put us in. You know, they put us in a sandbox and say, fight. And stepping outside of that voting booth, stepping outside of that sandbox and seeing, okay, well, here are the needs of my community. How can I address them without just petitioning a politician to please care about human beings? And that is really the idea of mutual aid and these community organizing efforts. And that is why these efforts are so important, not just during the pandemic to really take care of our communities, but they're going to be important afterwards. They are the antidote to a capitalist system, and they are the answer to what we can build afterwards.
Eleanor Goldfield, you're certainly giving us a lot to think about in terms of the system as a whole, and also the idea of mutual aid. I'm just reminded of the work that you do in and around Washington, D.C., but other parts of the country. Wanted to just take a quick opportunity here to give a thanks to the late Kevin Zeese, who passed away not long ago. Mm-hmm. His work with Margaret Flowers, Popular Resistance. I know you knew Kevin. He was a towering figure, certainly gone too soon. But and I'm pointing this out, too, because of the cross-generational importance, that there are younger people, there are older people that are really doing this and reaching across the divide. So I wondered if you could talk about the interactions that you have with people from all different walks of life who really get what you're talking about with mutual aid and grassroots activism. And if voting really is something that people are into, voting on the local level is something that's really key.
You make a great point. For instance, there's a ballot initiative here in Washington, D.C. about decriminalizing psilocybin mushrooms, which is great. And so something like that, and this is, of course, how we've seen the legalization of marijuana really take root in the United States. And so I think these local initiatives are very important, and people should absolutely be engaging with their local representatives on issues that affect your street. Thank you for bringing that up, because it is important to recognize that voting is not useless. And again, even if it's a presidential election and you feel strongly about it, I won't say that it's useless. Again, the context of that action is important. With regards to the generational issue, I absolutely think that that's important to highlight. And Kevin Zeese was a great friend and absolutely a mentor for me in a lot of ways. And I'm reminded of the Huey P. Newton quote, "The young always inherit the revolution." And I think that that is something that Black Panthers absolutely lived that philosophy. And I see it today even more, even though I'm kind of like in between. I'm not the older generation, but I'm not the youth anymore. And I see 16-year-olds that have a very strong anti-capitalist understanding. And I'm like, whoa, I did not have that kind of paradigm when I was 16. This is really impressive. And I think it really speaks to the acceleration of the deterioration of this system, that younger and younger people are becoming radicalized and understanding that the answer to our issues has to exist outside the confines of a capitalist system. And I'm incredibly inspired by people that are both older than me and younger than me. And I think that there's so much to learn from people who are older and so much to learn from people who are younger. It's really important in terms of organizing that we bring these perspectives together and recognize in terms of our storytelling abilities that we are writing the history that is not in the history books, and storytelling being a part of our grassroots activism, telling the many stories as opposed to the one history that we're taught. And this is a form of radicalism. This is a form of resilience. And in these stories, we recognize voting for Carter didn't change the trajectory of the United States. Oh, voting for Clinton didn't save the day. Understanding from history is so important. And then listening also to youth in terms of what do we need as we're growing up in this new age of climate chaos and a deteriorating empire and capitalism. And I think all of this taken together is really that sort of whole picture that we don't get from an incredibly divisive and narrow election cycle, that we don't get from particularly corporate media, which is something that you obviously in Project Centered work on so much. Understanding like the perspectives from older to younger are really important in crafting the kind of future that we absolutely need and want.
I find myself in a privileged position teaching, being around so many amazing people in my college work, so many different backgrounds, and in the work with Project Censored, working with so many people that have been doing this their entire lives, and then on the other end of the spectrum, people that are just coming into it. It's really amazing to behold. And I think that you're right to point out that the paradigm has been shifting. And what we're seeing younger and younger people wake up to these issues at a much earlier age, which is also pretty hopeful, meaning real hope, not just a campaign slogan or elixir. Eleanor Goldfield, you're also working on some other things, and I believe that you are going to be involved on an issue involving Native Americans in the Southwest.
Part of the mutual aid network is to, and obviously mutual aid is very localized when we're talking about like, oh, our community is working to make sure that our neighbors have access to food and medical supplies and things like that. But the networks that are being created, again, because this pandemic is hitting everybody at the same time. And I think that you pointed this out too, Mickey, that this pandemic has really laid bare the realities of the system and the extreme inequities of the system. So, for instance, Native Americans suffer perhaps the most under this system and are most marginalized, are most forgotten and purposely cast aside by the system since the advent of the United States. And so the pandemic has hit Native American communities and reservations incredibly hard. So one of the things that mutual aid networks are working to do is to amplify the needs and the voices of Indigenous folks at this point in time. And one of those, I've been in contact and working with folks in Navajo country and basically assessing needs there and how we can ensure that they get what they need. And also just recognizing that there's daily life stuff that has to be addressed, you know, like winterizing and chopping firewood for the coming winter. And these are things that in the midst of a pandemic, you might not think of, but that still need to get done so that people are as safe and healthy as they can be, and trying to get people access to tests and things like that. But we see government organizations such as FEMA failing continuously to address basic needs of the most marginalized communities. And so, again, this is something that the mutual aid networks have been really good at doing. And again, this really shows the planned and the programmed pitfalls of our system.
Eleanor Goldfield, again, among the many, many things that you do, and thank you for sharing the important information about mutual aid. Could you share with us, again, some websites, some places where people can follow your work? I know we didn't talk about Hard Road of Hope today. There's so much always to talk about with you, but that's an incredible film that looks at the working class resistance in West Virginia, hardroadofhope.com. Your other website is artkillingapathy.com. Are there other places people can follow the work that you do?
Those are the two sites that are about my work, but I would recommend that people check out Mutual Aid Disaster Relief. I think it's .org. But if you just look it up, then you'll find their website. They're kind of like a national network of local groups, and they've been really great at bringing people together and highlighting, like I mentioned, the Indigenous issues in this time. So I would recommend that folks check them out. And yeah, thank you. Thank you for mentioning Hard Road of Hope. I'm terrible at self-promotion. But yeah, the film's up at hardroadofhope.com, and everything that I do is up at artkillingapathy.com as well.
And of course, your podcast with Lee Camp, The Common Censored, the Silver Threads podcast with Carla Bergman. And again, remind our listeners that Eleanor Goldfield also contributes to other podcasts, By Any Means Necessary, Economic Update with Richard Wolf. Many of our listeners know that. Fault Lines, and so much more. Eleanor Goldfield, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Nikki. It's always a good time.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself along with Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, of this program, also the host, Anthony Fest, our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
About criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we flip the brother.